Good morning, everybody. This is about 2:41, November 5th. And we're going to finish up muscle chapter and move into the blood, heart, and circulation chapter in just a little bit. I'm going to turn these lights down, but I have an announcement. Some of you might have received 100% credit for the online weekly quiz for this week. And when you go back and look later this afternoon, you might notice that you no longer have 100%, and that's because I changed one of the answers from a wrong answer to a right answer. Okay, and it has to do with which electrolyte is most important in blood clotting function. And I erroneously selected sodium. That's the wrong answer, and if you selected it and got it correct, it is no longer correct. I don't know if that made any sense or not, but go back and take a look at those questions. And I don't know, does anybody know what the most important ion is for blood clotting function? Yeah, calcium, good, I heard it. Okay, so go back and check that and get all the points for that particular question. All right, so here is the schedule on the right-hand side. And we're going to start blood heart circulation. That's chapter 13, and that's the last chapter for the upcoming test. And the upcoming test is 1 week from today. So we have a lecture today, and then on Tuesday next week, and then Thursday, a lecture exam on 10, 11, 12, and 13. So we probably should get started. Does anybody have any questions over what we covered last time? You're pretty good with that, pretty good with the schedule. You know all that kind of stuff? Okay. So let me do this. All right, so we were talking about this slide last time, and I see something like myosin light chain kinase, myosin phosphatase. What can you tell me about the relationship between those two enzymes? They are? How would you describe that to somebody? Do they produce the same kind of response or something different? A phosphatase and a kinase. Where do I get my arrow options? This is a brand new program. End show, full screen. Edit slides, copy slide, print, zoom. Go to slide, previous next. Okay, I don't see an option. Okay, this arrow might bounce around a bunch because maybe it's going to disappear and then I have to get it to come back. Well, they're antagonistic to each other, right? A kinase phosphorylates something, a phosphatase removes the phosphate, and that enzyme then becomes active or inactive, and that activates another enzyme on myosin, which causes cross-bridge cycling. So this is in smooth muscle. Big difference between smooth muscle and skeletal muscle is that in smooth muscle, there are no sarcomeres. There are actin and myosin that slide over each other, but they're not arranged in that sarcomere the structure. And another thing is, calcium is important for contraction of both, controls contraction of both, but in cardiac muscle, and skeletal muscle, calcium binds to a molecule that's on the G-actin. What does it bind to on G-actin? Calcium binds to a regulatory protein on the G-actin filament. Does anybody know what that's called? You've got to in a week. Okay, calcium binds to troponin, and troponin then changes the conformation of tropomyosin. Tropomyosin is that big, long filament that covers up the binding sites for the myosin head group. Except when calcium's there, binds to troponin. Troponin then pulls tropomyosin out of the way so that the myosin head group can actually bind to the actin molecule. So calcium is important for the formation of cross bridges. Smooth muscle is activated by calcium as well, but in a little bit different way. It doesn't bind to troponin, it binds to calmodulin. They're cousin molecules, right? And the calcium-calmodulin complex can then activate this myosin light chain kinase, which then will phosphorylate a part of the myosin molecule, thereby activating it so cross bridges can cycle. All right, so you notice that there are a number of enzymatic steps right here. Each step is a level of amplification, and if there are a number of them, that's a cascade mechanism. But even though cascade mechanisms are known to be a way of speeding something up, it still takes much longer, okay, than excitation contraction coupling in skeletal and cardiac muscle. So smooth muscle contracts at a slower rate compared to cardiac and skeletal muscle, just because of the way that it's activated. All right, so there are basically two major kinds of smooth muscle. There's single unit and multi-unit. Single unit means that a whole bunch of muscle, smooth muscle cells will contract together, kind of like the heart muscle. All those heart cells will contract together. And then there are other kinds of smooth muscle cells that we call multi-unit, and they have to be stimulated individually. Right? So it doesn't act as a unit. The single unit has gap junctions, just like cardiac muscle, so just one smooth muscle cell depolarizes, and then that depolarization moves from one smooth muscle cell to the next, to the next, to the next, causing excitation and then contraction. Some of the cells within single unit smooth muscle can act as pacemakers. They spontaneously depolarize by themselves by having maybe a leaky sodium channel. So sodium leaks inside the cell, depolarizing it to threshold, and then when an action potential starts in that smooth muscle cell, it moves to neighboring smooth muscle cells through these gap junctions. All right, so that's single unit. Multi-unit, on the other hand, requires nerve stimulation by the autonomic nervous system. And you know something about the autonomic nervous system. Tell me, how many divisions does it have? There are two, right? And what's the relationship between them? They're antagonistic to each other, right? Sympathetic and parasympathetic. Right, so the autonomic nervous system can affect or influence the rate of contraction and the strength of contraction, and it does so by releasing neurotransmitters at the tip, not at the tip of an axon like we were normally thinking, but through varicosities or swellings along an axon that contain synaptic vesicles. So here is the cell body dendrites, here is the axon. And as a nerve impulse passes down this axon, it depolarizes this varicosity, which then releases neurotransmitter, not just at the tip of the axon, but all along its whole length. So sometimes we call these synapses en passant, in passing. As the nerve impulse passes by, it releases neurotransmitter. Okay, so if it's multi-unit smooth muscle, right, then there can be autonomic innervation from both the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system. And in that particular case, then that smooth muscle cell will then have to balance out, right, the effect of the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system, and therefore that smooth muscle cell can actually make a decision on what to do based on the influence of the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous systems, because these neurotransmitters produce what kind of potential on a smooth muscle cell? An action potential or a graded potential? Okay, it's going to be due to a ligand-gated channel. When these neurons release neurotransmitter, right, it's going to influence the smooth muscle cell because there's a ligand-gated channel right there. So what does a ligand-gated channel produce, action or graded? Graded potential, right. And so if there is inhibitory, if there are EPSPs and IPSPs, then the smooth muscle cell right here, right, they will summate, and that will basically make a decision for this smooth muscle cell what to do, unlike skeletal muscle, which always results in an action potential, which is always excitatory, always depolarization. And that's it for this particular chapter. Okay. So, guys ready to go to the next one? Any questions on that? Yeah. So that the myosin head group can bind to the actin molecule. And that's in skeletal and cardiac muscle. Skeletal and cardiac. Smooth muscle, on the other hand, calcium binds to a cousin molecule that we call calmodulin. Calmodulin. Yeah, so troponin on skeletal and cardiac, calmodulin in smooth muscle. All right. So here is our next chapter. There's a lot of review in this particular chapter that you should pull out your anatomy book for, because we don't have time to go over it, and you guys are going to be bored with it anyway, so I'm not going to go over it. But let's review some of the functions of the circulatory system. Right, so circulatory system is filled with blood. Blood is a connective tissue, but it's kind of strange because it's a fluid connective tissue. It flows, and so it does connect all the different parts of your body because it flows from one region to another. Things can be transported in the blood, like oxygen delivery, nutrients, enzymes, and it will even deliver hormones to various tissues. Right, so transport is important, and also transport of waste products out of your body. Transport of heat. So heat's not a chemical compound, but it can be transmitted from one part of your body to another, like from a muscle that is exercising and is getting really hot. That heat can be picked up by the blood, delivered to the surface, and then can be radiated from your body, or it might trigger like a sweating response. So heat transfer is another important function of the cardiovascular system. And that helps maintain homeostasis of body temperature. Cardiovascular system also regulates fluid levels around cells and electrolyte levels and pH balance. And I think you're getting a pretty good idea how important it is to regulate intracellular and extracellular electrolytes. Somebody give me an example of an electrolyte. What's an electrolyte? Some kind of ion, right? Could be a cation or an anion, like sodium ions, potassium ions, chloride ions, right? And also the blood has an immune function, so it protects the body from infection. And since blood is a fluid, if a blood vessel gets damaged, that fluid is going to run out of your body, right? Through bleeding. So another function of blood is that it can turn into a solid to stop blood loss when blood vessels are damaged. So we're going to look at a number of these different things. Components of the cardiovascular system, okay, is the heart, blood vessels, right? But we also want to consider the lymphatic system part of the cardiovascular system. And we talked about that in anatomy. And that is that plasma leaks out of capillaries into interstitial spaces. A lot of it gets resorbed at the distal end of a capillary, but not all of it. So tissue spaces do get filled up with excess fluid, and we would swell up. What do we call that when we swell up? Edema, yeah. But the lymphatic system takes that excess fluid and returns it back to the cardiovascular system via the lymph vessels. Okay, blood. So whole blood has a couple major components to it, and we're going to see that there is a fluid part that we call plasma, and then another part that's made up of cells, and all that, the whole compartment we're going to call formed elements. So things dissolve in plasma. Plasma is mostly water, 92%, and the rest are proteins, and then some other kinds of things as well. Here are three major classes of proteins. Albumin. Albumin is just a particle, and this is in blood to help absorb water or fluid from tissue spaces, right? And this increases the osmolality of blood, and so that has a tendency to draw fluid from tissue spaces back into the blood at a capillary. Albumin comes from the liver, and when the liver gets damaged, chemotherapy, cancer, cirrhosis, any kind of damage to the liver, then the liver can't produce albumin, right? And then what is going to be the result in somebody? Okay, if the osmolality of blood decreases, then it's going to have less tendency to absorb water from tissue spaces, and that produces edema. Okay, so albumins help fight edema from occurring. Globulins fight infections, and globulins also transport hydrophobic compounds around, like thyroid hormone. And the last kind of protein are clotting factors. These are the kinds of proteins that prevent blood loss when there's damage to a blood vessel. Then there's other things that dissolve in water like sugar, right, and then ions, gases, various waste products like CO2. Okay, these clotting factors can produce a blood clot, and sometimes we actually want to have blood stay in its liquid form. And that can happen if we take plasma and remove the clotting factors from it. So if you take the plasma, remove clotting factors, then we get something that we call serum. And sometimes we actually call it anti-serum because serum, right, is just missing clotting factors, But it does contain globulins that can fight infections. It can contain antibodies. All right, so serum or anti-serum might be given to somebody if they've been envenomated by a poisonous snake or something. So they're basically given the plasma from a donor animal minus the clotting factors because we don't want that person to have clots forming in their circulatory system. But we do want those antibodies to protect that person. All right, then formed elements. Basically, there are three kinds: red blood cells, white blood cells, and platelets. Red blood cells carry oxygen in our body. Erythro means red, so erythrocyte is exactly the same thing as a red blood cell. And leuko means white. A leukocyte and a white blood cell are exactly the same. They don't transport oxygen around. They fight infection. They're part of your immune response. And platelets, a very small percentage of platelets, these are called thrombocytes because they're important in preventing blood loss when there's damage to a blood vessel. So these are the major formed elements. Okay. And sometimes we would like to know what the percentage of formed elements is in blood compared to a whole blood sample. And that is hematocrit, right? Hematocrit is just the percentage of red blood cells in whole blood. In women, it's usually between 36-46%, and men 41-53%, so it's a little bit higher in men on average. There's a lot of overlap there. And the way that we calculate hematocrit is that we need a whole blood sample, and then we need to separate formed elements from plasma. And if you just set a test tube out overnight, that will happen. But if you want to know an answer quickly, then you take this tube and put it in a centrifuge and spin it around so that all the heavy stuff in blood end up at the bottom of the tube. The lighter stuff, namely plasma, is on the top, and in between are white blood cells. Okay, and you can see them, but it's a very small percentage, so we really don't include that or subtract that from the calculation of hematocrit. But hematocrit, typically, or the exact definition, is the percentage of red blood cells, not platelets and not white blood cells altogether, but just red blood cells. All right, so here I can see some illustrations of red blood cells, some white blood cells, and then you can see how small platelets are as well. All right, so here's a question that I'm not going to go over, but you can go over it. All right, if an 80 ml sample of whole blood from a normal individual contained 30 ml of erythrocytes, 0.72 ml of leukocytes, and 4 ml of thrombocytes after centrifuging, is a sample from a man or a woman? All right, so calculate the hematocrit, and hopefully I've arranged this question so that you're not going to be in this overlap between man and woman right here. You're going to be on one side or the other, and that will just tell yourself if you know how to calculate hematocrit. Okay, and that's actually really, really easy to do. Okay, so one of the reasons, or one way that you might want to determine hematocrit, maybe somebody is very dehydrated. Maybe they've lost a lot of fluid. Maybe they've stopped drinking, and you want to transfuse some fluids into this person, and you don't want to over-transfuse, give them too much fluid, and you don't want to under-transfuse because their blood is going to get really slushy or stay really slushy. And so a good way to do that is just to measure what the hematocrit is, calculate how much fluid you have to give somebody to bring the hematocrit back to a normal range. So it's done routinely. Okay. Okay, plasma proteins. We talked about these a little bit. Okay, albumins are important because they prevent edema from forming. Globulins carry lipids, and there are also antibodies. These are molecules that fight infection. Third one was fibrinogen. That's a clotting factor. When we look at fibrinogen, there's a special little suffix on this word. If you see a word and there's an ogen, well, I'm not going to be able to live with this program if I can't find my cursor. Here it is. Okay, here is an ogen at the end of the word. That is significant because it means that this compound right here is in the blood. Okay, or it exists wherever it exists, but it is in an inactive form, ogen, inactive. But the nice thing about that is that it can be activated in a moment's notice. So if your body needs fibrin, it doesn't have to initiate protein synthesis to build the proper levels of fibrin. It's already in the blood, ready to go. So fibrinogen just converted, is converted into fibrin, and then it performs its function of hemostasis, or preventing blood loss. All right, so those are plasma proteins, and plasma proteins are in plasma. I guess that makes sense. Okay, formed elements. White blood cells, erythrocytes. There are five different kinds, some of them fight infection, some help maintain the fluid nature of blood, okay? But basically, they're there for immune response. Red blood cells, on the other hand, which I see over here, okay? Here I see some red blood cells. They're kind of like discs, and they have a dimple in the center of them, and that's because that increases the surface-to-volume ratio. So that increases the surface area for exchange. So red blood cells can absorb oxygen to a large degree just because of the shape of the cells. Red blood cells only live for about 120 days. When they're damaged, they can't repair themselves because they are anucleate. There is no nucleus to initiate protein synthesis, for instance, if they need a protein that was damaged. And then they die, and which means then that your body has to replace them. And it just so happens that we lose about 2 to 3 million red blood cells every second, right? And if we lose too many red blood cells, our hematocrit goes down. That causes, does anybody know what that's caused, what it's called when we have a deficiency in red blood cells in our body? Yeah, you all know that. Okay, it's anemia. So if you lose 2 to 3 million red blood cells every second, how many does your body have to build every second so that you don't become anemic? The same amount, right, to maintain homeostasis. So between 2 to 3 million every second, which corresponds to about 300 billion every single day. So you guys are really busy. I'm busy too, right, no matter what I'm doing, building red blood cells, many of them. Okay. And in each red blood cell, there are about 280 million hemoglobin molecules, and hemoglobin is the molecule that carries oxygen, and every hemoglobin can carry 4 oxygens. All right, so they're just a huge number of oxygen molecules that can be carried by red blood cells. Leukocytes. There are basically two kinds. Granular leukocytes help detoxify substances and release heparin. That's an anticoagulant. Here are the granular leukocytes, eosinophils, basophils, and neutrophils. And the other kind are agranular leukocytes, and these fight infection. These are the most important for fighting infection. For instance, like lymphocytes. Lymphocytes then can differentiate into other kinds of lymphocytes, like B lymphocytes and T lymphocytes, but basically they fight infection. B lymphocytes produce antibodies. T lymphocytes are contact killers, so if they bump into a bacteria that doesn't belong in your body, then the contact killer will lyse that bacteria and destroy it. An antibody will do the same thing. An antibody is a particle that's produced by a B lymphocyte, so the B lymphocyte doesn't have to come in contact with a bacteria, but some of its products does in order to kill that particular bacteria. All right, so if we have white blood cells, right, what part of blood do white cells belong to? What are the two major components in blood? You got plasma and formed elements. So white blood cells belong to formed elements, right? Okay, platelets live for even a shorter period of time. They are anucleate as well. They're actually cell fragments, right? They survive from 5 to 9 days, and then they're replaced. And that process of replacing blood cells is called hematopoiesis. So any kind of blood cell that is being replaced by a process called hematopoiesis. And we talked about how many that is every day. Red bone marrow produces about 500 billion blood cells every day. In the fetus, that occurs in the liver. And red bone marrow is in bones, in the medullary cavity of bones. So that tissue is what we call a myeloid tissue, if it has stem cells to produce blood cells. Erythropoiesis is a subset of hematopoiesis, erythropoiesis is the formation of red blood cells in particular. And it's under endocrine control, a hormone from the kidney. And that hormone from the kidney is called erythropoietin. And erythro, again, just signifies that it is controlling red blood cell production. Right? Leukopoiesis, on the other hand, is a term that's refers to the production of white blood cells. And there are a variety of different kinds of compounds in the blood that we call cytokines and other kinds of regulators from the immune system that help regulate the production of, and types of white blood cells. So erythro, kind of talked about this slide already. Here is an important physiology type slide. All right, so the kidney can monitor oxygen levels. Right, and what's the cell in blood that carries oxygen? Red blood cells, right? So since the kidney can monitor oxygen, it's also measuring the concentration of red blood cells. And as the concentration of oxygen decreases, then the kidney is going to secrete erythropoietin. And the liver can do the same thing, but it's primarily the kidney. Right, erythropoietin is a hormone, which means it gets into the blood via capillary, goes to red bone marrow, where it signals the stem cells to produce more red blood cells. And as your body produces more red blood cells, the oxygen concentration increases. And so how does that relate to the initial stimulus? What was the initial stimulus? Was low oxygen in the blood. The response is to increase oxygen in the blood, so they subtract from each other, so that's a nice negative feedback mechanism, maintaining homeostasis. And erythropoietin, the genetically engineered kind, is called EPO, is a pharmaceutical type grade of erythropoietin. Okay, well, we talked about one important function of blood is that it prevents blood loss when a blood vessel is damaged, but it can also it's also important for fighting infection. So there are two different things that we're going to look at. The first thing we're going to look at is immune response of red blood cells. There are compounds that act as signposts on the cell surface that basically define what kind of cell it is, what organism it belongs to, and we call all of those things antigens. There are antigens present on the red blood cell surface, and they specify the blood type in particular. All right, so antigens, just remember, are on the plasma membrane. They're sticking out extracellularly. And there are a number of different antigen systems, but one major one is the ABO system. And if somebody has type A blood, right, they have an antigen that we're going to call the A antigen. So the type of blood is determined by the presence of an antigen on the surface of the red blood cell. There are different shaped antigens. Another one has a different shape, and there's probably the second one that they found, and so they call it a B antigen. So cells, red blood cells, can have an A antigen, or they can have a B antigen, or they can even have both, right? If they have both of these antigens, then that's type AB blood. And then some people have red blood cells with neither antigen on the cell surface, right? And so that was really confusing for scientists for a long period of time. Right, because the first one they named A, the second one they named B, and then they ran into one with nothing, and so it felt really strange to name it C because A and B actually meant something. C also has a connotation of meaning something. So they wanted to name it zero. And they go, well, that doesn't make sense because we got letters and now we got a number. That doesn't make sense. And then somebody said, oh, I have an idea. Let's just call it O. And that's like a zero, so that is good. All right, so that is the ABO system. And let me just write something down on the board. I can't write something down on the board. Because I don't have a marker. Okay, let me try this. I don't know if you guys can see this. All right, so blood type. What do we got? We got A, What else do we have? Oh, that's going to work. A, B, A, B, and O. All right, so there's two things that we want to be concerned about. We want to be concerned about antigens, right? And the other thing are antibodies. And in the ABO system, your body will just automatically produce antibodies according to this chart that we're going to work on. All right, so if somebody has type A blood, what can you tell me about antigen? They have that shaped antigen, an A-shaped antigen, on the cell surface. All right, so blood type A has A antigen, and that person then automatically produces an antibody against B. All right, so then we're going to put anti-B right here. If somebody has blood type B, they have a different shaped antigen on red blood cell surface that we're going to call B. And the antibody that person produces is anti-A. And another case, if somebody has blood type AB, they have both, right? A and B antigens on the cells, those red blood cell surfaces. Now, if somebody's AB, what about antibodies in their serum? They can't have antibodies for A or B, so we're going to say none. Right here. All right. And then for the O person, in terms of antigens, there are none. And in terms of antibodies, it's what? Both. Anti-A and anti-B. All right. So that's basically the ABO system. And how does that work? Well, if we have a red blood cell right here, here is an antigen on the cell surface. And from this, you should be able to tell me what is the blood type of that red blood cell. It's A, because it has an A antigen on it, right? Okay. And then consequently, here's another red blood cell. Right? Tell me what kind of blood type this is. Don't tell me yet, because I'm not done drawing. What blood type is that? That's AB, right? And then what type is this over here? Oh, it's O, right? Because it has no antigens on the cell surface. Okay. Well, the A type produces anti-B. And an antibody kind of looks like a person with two arms, right? So here's a person with two arms. And here are the arms over here. There are some receptor sites on either one of these arms. And I'm going to draw something that looks like this. All right, so this is an antibody. What kind of antibody is it? Is it anti-A or anti-B? It's anti-B, right? Because this site will bind to a B, right? So this is an anti-B antibody. Okay, so if we put another red blood cell right here, and there's a B on it, this antibody can bind both of these cells together, and then eventually these are going to lyse. They're going to be destroyed due to the action of this antibody. All right, so this particular person is not going to have an antibody that looks like what? Like this. So what kind of blood type is going to produce an antibody that looks like that? It's going to be type B, right? Blood type B. Or O, either one, okay? So because blood type O has both anti-A and anti-B. There is another kind of blood clotting system called Rh. All right, so here is Rh, and that is either positive or negative. And in order to be positive, you have to have the antigen, the Rh antigen, on the surface of the cell. All right, so here is a blood cell. What is the blood type of the cell right here? I like O. I like O because I don't see A and B here. Okay, and because it has the antigen, it's positive. Right, so this is an O positive type blood. Okay, because there's no A or B. And here's an O. So then this one over here, if we put an Rh right here, what's the blood type of this red blood cell? That would be a positive, right? And what about this one right here? In terms of both systems, it's AB negative because there's no RH factor on it, right? So I'll probably draw at least one red blood cell on the test and ask you what kind of blood type it is, and then you can tell me. Okay, we automatically produce these antibodies depending on our blood type, but if somebody is RH negative and they're missing these RH antigens, they don't automatically produce anti-RH, right? Like these anti-A's and anti-B's. If somebody's RH negative, in order to produce anti-RH, they have to be sensitized to somebody's blood that is RH positive first. And that's important, for instance, in gestation. Because if a mom is RH negative, right, no antigens on the cell surface, and the father is RH positive, then the baby has a 50-50 chance of being RH positive. And if that's an RH positive baby inside an RH negative mom, then there can be an antibody antigen reaction. And that's called erythroblastosis fetalis, or hemolytic disease of the newborn. It does not happen on the first pregnancy because the mom doesn't automatically make anti-RH. But if there is mixing of fetal and maternal blood during delivery, then the second or third or fourth pregnancies, there can be a problem. And then the fetal red blood cells will be lysed in the body and they'll be anemic. And hemoglobin, okay, is going to be released, and there's just going to be a huge overload of hemoglobin in the fetus, and that's what produces jaundice when that hemoglobin is broken down. And that bilirubin, which produces jaundice, is toxic to developing nerve systems. So that is a serious condition. And so if a mom is RH negative, then we like to suppress the immune system for that mom if it's possible that they could have an RH positive baby. Okay. Well, it's sort of interesting. I've had a couple questions go, and the question is, well, what happens if, okay, the mom is A, okay, and the baby happens to be, well, it can't be an O, okay, how about mom is A and, okay, I'll have to think about that question for another time. If there's a mismatch in antibodies in the ABO system, it doesn't affect the fetus because these anti-A's and anti-B's are too big to go across the placenta. But the anti-RH's are small enough to get across the placenta to produce that condition. So this process that we're talking about is what we call agglutination. Right, so here is that antibody, and it binds just by the basis of shape to antigens on the surface of red blood cells. So it can bind red blood cells together and then lyse these cells. This process is what we call agglutination. When they get joined together, that's what we call agglutinate. And so what kind of reaction is agglutination? What kind of reaction? It is an antibody antigen reaction, right? Agglutination is an antibody antigen reaction that produces clumping of red blood cells. And here are like some red blood cells that are all clumped together. And that's going to resemble another kind of process that's used to prevent blood loss, which is called coagulation. So I do want you to know, be really familiar with the difference between coagulation and agglutination. All right, we talked about the RH factor. All right, so now we're going to talk about coagulation, or the prevention of blood loss. There are two main ways. Hemostasis is a term that refers to prevention of blood loss when there's damage to a blood vessel. The first one is platelet plug formation. This is for very small tears in blood vessels. And the other one is fibrin formation, or coagulation. Fibrin formation and coagulation are the same thing. And coagulation is not an antibody antigen reaction. We're going to see what it is in just a second. So fiber information for large tears. The role of platelets. We're looking at a blood vessel, right? And I see the endothelium in a blood vessel. That's just a lining, and that's just what, a nice simple squamous epithelium. It's nice and slippery so that these red blood cells can slide right through these blood vessels. And when the blood vessel is normal, the endothelium is secreting prostacyclin, right? We're just going to call this PGI2. It's also going to be secreting nitric oxide, and this prevents clots from forming. So these compounds are in high concentration when the wall of a blood vessel is normal, right? And also the endothelium can take can actually get rid of ADP. ADP is just a product of ATP hydrolysis. There's always some around. ADP is an activator of blood clotting. And so this enzyme, the CD39 enzyme, which is active in a normal endothelium, gets rid of ADP, which then keeps platelets in an inactive form. All right, so here I see an illustration, and these look like red blood cells, but I think the artist meant for these things to really be platelets, right? So these are inactive platelets because PGI2 is high, nitric oxide is high, and there's very little ADP under normal circumstances. The connective tissue underneath the endothelium, right, has some strong fibers. What's the strongest fiber that you know of? Collagen. So these are collagen fibers, and in a normal blood vessel, they're not exposed to the blood, right? They're nicely contained underneath an epithelium within the connective tissue. So I see collagen fibers, right? There's also something that is not exposed to the blood in a normal blood vessel, and that's called von Willebrand's factor. So they're hidden from blood. When they're exposed to blood, then it can activate some mechanisms. Let's take a look. All right, so this blood vessel is damaged. And now collagen is exposed to plasma, and the von Willebrand factor is exposed to plasma. And the von Willebrand factor increases the stickiness of platelets to collagen. So platelets will have a tendency to stick to collagen that is enhanced with this von Willebrand factor. If somebody doesn't have von Willebrand factor, then they will have reduced clotting function and they'll have a tendency to bleed as a result of that. And when platelets stick, okay, to collagen molecules, they release ADP, they release serotonin, and another prostaglandin, what we call thromboxane A2, right, or taxa A2. So these compounds will do a couple of things. They will attract other platelets and cause them to stick to this region. Serotonin will cause vasoconstriction of this blood vessel, so it prevents blood from getting into this area, helping preventing blood loss. And this is what we call the platelet release reaction. When these platelets become activated, releasing ADP, taxa-2, and serotonin. And this is for very, very small plugs, or very, very small tears in a blood vessel. Okay, and one of the last things that happens is that this platelet plug right here will be infiltrated with something we call fibrin, and that will then really seal this damaged area over. So what is the role of fibrin? This is the second kind of blood clotting function. Okay, so there are just a number of things. I'm not going to go over this slide right here, but basically there are two ways that your body can produce fibrin, intrinsic and extrinsic. And let's take a look at an exam figure. So here is an important exam figure for coagulation. All right, and the end product, what is the end product of coagulation? What's the very last thing that's being formed right here? Fibrin. Yeah, so coagulation and fibrin formation are the same thing, right? So coagulation is not an antibody-antigen reaction, it is fibrin formation. So make sure you see the difference between agglutination and coagulation. All right, so here I see extrinsic pathway, intrinsic pathway, they're joined together, right, forming a common pathway right here. Eventually, we have fibrin formation. And there are a number of enzymes that can be activated. Right? And so if you have an enzyme and it catalyzes a reaction, what can it do with that reaction again? Over and over and over again, right? So enzymes act as a level of amplification, and we see a number of enzymatic reactions, and what do we call that? That's a cascade mechanism, right? So that's a way of making something happen fast and increase the magnitude of that reaction. Okay, so what I would like for you to see on this diagram, a couple things, right? That for this extrinsic pathway and intrinsic pathway, the ion that's necessary for proper clotting function is calcium, right? And calcium. Without proper calcium, blood won't clot. That's a bad thing. Also, phospholipids are necessary for both the intrinsic and extrinsic pathway. And when a blood vessel is damaged, where on earth are you going to get phospholipids from? Yeah, just from the membranes, right? That's just a natural component of membranes when they get damaged. Release phospholipids, which aids, right, in clotting function. All right, so clotting function is basically these three steps right here. Prothrombin activator formation. And this is it, factor 10. So factor 10 normally is inactive, but it can be activated by a number of things, right? Different kinds of clotting factors in the presence of calcium and phospholipids. Factor 10, when it becomes activated, will then activate prothrombin. Well, we looked at fibrinogen before because there's an O-gen at the end of the word, which means what? Plenty of it around, but it is inactive. Same thing for prothrombin, but just a little bit different. It's not the suffix, it's the prefix. A lot of times when you see a word with pro in front of it, it means it's present, but it's present in an inactive form and can be converted into an active form very quickly. Right, so prothrombin is a reservoir for thrombin that can be activated very quickly, and what activates prothrombin, or what converts prothrombin into thrombin, is prothrombin activator or factor 10. Thrombin is necessary. Okay, thrombin is necessary because it will convert fibrinogen to fibrin. And fibrinogen is soluble in water. Fibrin is insoluble. So when thrombin is activated, it precipitates fibrin protein from plasma. And that fibrin protein are just threads of proteins, and this is what it looks like. So here I see a bunch of red blood cells, and I see fibrin precipitate. These are all just protein threads that glue all of these red blood cells, platelets, and white blood cells together. All right, well, since we're on this slide, coagulation is what kind of formation? Fibrin formation, not antibody-antigen reaction. All right, so these are the three important steps. Prothrombin activator formation, thrombin formation, and then fibrin formation, and these are due to enzymatic activity. So what do we see here? An important cascade mechanism. And what does this cascade mechanism need? It needs calcium and phospholipids as well. And if you want to prevent blood from clotting, you can remove the calcium from it. You can't remove calcium from a person because then they'll bleed to death. But if you have a whole blood sample that you don't want to coagulate, you want to keep it around for research purposes or some kind of analysis, then if you just remove the calcium from solution, it won't clot. And there's a compound that will do that. It's called a chelator, EDTA. And if blood has EDTA in it, then you know that's just not normal blood. That has been treated by some kind of specialist to prevent blood from clotting. Okay. The other important thing that I see on this slide right here is vitamin K. Vitamin K is important for producing prothrombin. Without vitamin K, prothrombin won't be formed, and this last step of fibrin formation won't take place. So where do you get vitamin K from? It's not potassium, but vitamin K. Vitamin K is from green leafy vegetables, like broccoli, for instance. And people that don't eat green leafy vegetables like broccoli can suffer from clotting function deficiencies. And that kind of reminds me of my nephews when they were growing up. There's three boys, all about the same age. they'd horse around in the house, right? And invariably somebody would be thrown into the couch or a table and get a bloody nose. And then they come over to Uncle Joel and want some sympathy. And I would say, well, you know what? You should eat your broccoli next time. And they would say, no, I just can't do that. And so I would sit down with this clotting, this coagulation, intrinsic, extrinsic pathway, show them how important vitamin K is, right? And you get that from broccoli. And, you know, my nephews, they would rather bleed to death at that age than eat broccoli. So that was sort of interesting. So vitamin K is necessary. There is something else I want to point out to you. Thrombin not only converts fibrinogen to fibrin, but thrombin helps activate factor 11. Okay, and then factor 11 helps activate some other compounds, which then activates prothrombin activator, right, which activates more thrombin, which activates more 11, which activates more thrombin, which activates more 11. What does that sound like to you? A positive feedback mechanism, right? Okay, so positive feedback is also necessary, right, and a normal circumstance for clotting function. Without positive feedback, then that clotting function is going to be drastically reduced. And the anticoagulant heparin blocks thrombin from activating factor 11 right here. All right, so just this one little step right here, if it's blocked, that reduces clotting function. So here is another nifty example of where positive feedback is normal and necessary in a normal individual. And what's the kind of feedback mechanism that usually maintains homeostasis? Negative. So it's rare to have a positive feedback mechanism. But here is a really good example. All right, so you see these three steps right here? Prothrombin activator formation, thrombin formation, ending up with fibrin formation, and all of these things rely on a positive feedback mechanism and proper levels of calcium and phospholipids, right? And where is calcium usually found? At a high concentration outside the cell, right? So that works with this scheme really, really nice. There's a condition, and I have to look this up on the internet, right? There's a condition called hemophilia, and a person with hemophilia produces no factor 8, right? So this intrinsic pathway with this positive feedback mechanism doesn't happen, and these people could bleed to death with just a little paper cut on their finger. And the way that was treated with transfusions of blood, and this is a genetically carried disorder, okay? Sort of like color blindness. It skips generations. It's a sex-linked trait. And I had some friends years ago, right? And since they were treated with whole blood, right, a lot of hemophiliacs died of AIDS because we didn't know AIDS was a disease for many years. And I don't even know if there's any hemophiliacs alive anymore as a result of that. So that's why I need to get to the internet to find out. Okay. There are other kinds of blood clotting disorders like thalassemias, right? And hemophilia is one of the more important ones. Okay, so that's what you got to know about this particular slide. Is it more manageable now that we talked about it? Hopefully. Positive feedback, phospholipids, calcium, these three steps in the common factor, in the common pathway. And just remember, coagulation is fibrin formation. Fibrin is an insoluble protein in plasma, while fibrinogen is soluble. Okay, so that is coagulation. All right, well, in order to have precise control and balance in your body, what's typically employed? Two mechanisms that are antagonistic to each other, right? So when you have a tear in a blood vessel and coagulation takes place and that tear is plugged up or repaired, okay, you still don't want blood clots to form everywhere in your body, right? So can you imagine what would happen to somebody if everywhere in their body blood started to clot? Then blood wouldn't flow, right? And so that's a coagulopathy that does happen for people under some circumstances when a lot of things happen to them, like maybe they're diabetic, they have high blood pressure, have a heart attack, okay, and other things happening, then they can get into that kind of condition. Usually it's prevented because Not only are there compounds that function to produce a blood clot, there are compounds that dissolve blood clots in our body, right? So there's antagonism built into that. And the compound or the enzyme that breaks fibrin down is plasmin. And plasmin is produced in an inactive form that's called plasminogen. Could you tell me that plasminogen is an inactive enzyme? Yeah, because of the O-gen. All right, there are some compounds that can activate plasminogen or convert it into plasmin. And kallikrein is one of them. Tissue plasminogen activator is another. Right, and that will activate plasmin, and then blood clots will be dissolved as a result of that. Do we have this here? No. Okay. Well, so that tissue plasminogen activator is a really good, nice way that we can treat somebody if they have a blood clot in their heart or their brain. What do we call a blood clot in the brain? That's a stroke, right? So that's a stroke. And you can get strokes for other reasons. For instance, if you have bleeding in the brain due to a ruptured blood vessel, that will cause a stroke as well. So two main reasons. Blood is leaking out, or blood can't get in because there is a plug. Well, of course, you need to have some pretty sophisticated diagnostic tools, because you just don't want to give tissue plasminogen activator to somebody that's having a stroke, because what if they're having a stroke because they have a bleeding disorder? Right, and then you give them something that activates plasmin, what's going to happen to bleeding in the brain? It's going to be worse, right? So you're going to make that stroke a lot worse. But if somebody is having a stroke because of a blood clot, then plasmin is a really good way to treat that kind of stroke. And there are some really good hospitals around here in LA that can do that diagnosis, but it's still kind of uncommon. Anticoagulants. We talked about heparin, right, that blocks thrombin. Coumarin blocks coagulation by inhibiting activation of vitamin K, which indirectly works by reducing calcium availability in that clotting pathway. Oh, we talked about chelators, right, like sodium citrate or EDTA will bind calcium, that's free calcium ions in solution, preventing coagulation as well. But that we can't give to somebody, right? That works really nice in a test tube, but not in a person. Heparin and coumarin, right, are nice pharmaceuticals that we can use. All right, so here, let's think about the heart. How many chambers does the heart have? Yeah, and I don't hear a lot of people yelling that out, okay? And you guys really should yell this out by now. How many chambers does the heart have? Four. How many valves does the heart have? Oh, you got to yell it out. That's four, right? How many chambers does the heart have? Four. How many valves does the heart have? Four, right? Now you just got to know their names, right? So that's some of your homework for over the weekend, right? And then how many sides does the heart have? Two, right? There's a left side and a right side. And that's important because that tells you how many circulations are there in the body. There are two, right? There's the pulmonary and systemic circulation. So I want to go over that really quick once again. How many chambers does the heart have? Four. How many valves? Four. How many sides? Two. How many circulations? Two. Okay. All right, so here is a really good slide that you should appreciate. Maybe you should be able to write this down, trace a drop of blood through these various places. Right, so here I see the right heart, that's one side. Here's the left heart. So the left heart pumps blood to what we call the systemic circulation, which is a very large circulation. It's everywhere in your body except the lungs. Right, that comes from the left ventricle. The right ventricle only pumps blood through the lungs, which is a lot shorter, a lot smaller circulation. Okay, and because of that, because it's a smaller circulation, it doesn't need the same kind of pressure to get from the right ventricle back to the left atrium. Since the systemic circulation is a lot longer, it takes a lot more energy to pump blood through that circulation, so the left side of the heart has to produce more pressure, which means that the left side of the heart has to be stronger than the right side. So that's important. All right, but here is one other thing. And that is the amount of blood that's pumped by the right ventricle has to equal the amount of blood that's pumped by the left ventricle, otherwise blood is going to get stuck someplace or back up, right? And the way the heart does that is by adjusting the pressure. The pressure in the pulmonary artery is a lot lower compared to blood pressure in the aorta, right? And that's just because of the resistance of these different circuits. All right, so here I see some molecules like oxygen with arrows pointing to them, right? CO2 arrows. So here we have oxygen going in, CO2 coming out. So what kind of blood vessel allows for exchange? Only capillaries, right? So not arteries, not veins that we see, and that's because capillaries are really, really thin. All right, so make sure you know all these valves right here, but right now, tell me what's the function of a valve? Why do we have valves in our heart? To make sure that blood is flowing in one direction, right? So the heart is pumping blood, so it goes in one direction. If blood flows backwards, that's eventually going to kill the heart. We call that retrograde flow. We want anterograde flow through the heart. So these valves have to be competent, they have to be working, and they just make sure that we have anterograde flow of blood through these different blood vessels. Okay. I don't think I want to go over these valves at all. Just make sure you know that there's two circulations, and probably in red, unless it's green, the rate of flow through the systemic circulation must equal the rate of flow through the pulmonary circulation, right? And that's good for you to know. All right, so the left ventricle works about 5 to 7 times greater because of higher resistance in the systemic circulation, okay? Okay, you can have high blood pressure, right? Hypertension, and that's pretty easy to measure. How do you measure hypertension or high blood pressure typically? On somebody's arm, right? You put a pressure cuff. Maybe you do this in lab. Sometimes you're going to do that in lab. All right, so when you measure blood pressure that way, what circulation are you measuring blood pressure in? The pulmonary circulation or systemic circulation? Only the systemic circulation, right? So that's a way of monitoring systemic hypertension, but it has no way to tell you if there is pulmonary hypertension, and there can be such a thing as pulmonary hypertension, right? That's really hard to do because to measure pulmonary hypertension, you have to get to an artery that's deep inside the thorax, right? But if there's pulmonary hypertension, which means higher blood pressure than normal, that's developed by the right ventricle here, okay, what happens to a muscle when it starts to exercise more? It gets bigger, right? And so there's a way that you can actually find, right, increased mass of the right ventricle due to pulmonary hypertension on an ECG that you guys are going to do in lab. And it's called the mean electrical axis of the heart. Have you done that in lab yet? No. Okay. Well, so that's one way to look indirectly at if somebody has pulmonary hypertension, just by looking at an ECG. Okay, I'll let you guys do that in lab. Heart valves, make sure, how many valves are there? You got 4, right, 2 atrioventricular, 2 semilunar valves. All right, that's going to take us to the cardiac cycle. What time are we done in here today? 45? Yeah, okay, good. Okay, cardiac cycle. Well, we said that the heart is a pump. It's not the typical kind of pump that we're usually thinking of, and that's because the usual kind of pump is pumping all the time. Like an electrical pump, it's just pumping. But the heart is what we call a reciprocating pump. Sometimes it's pumping, sometimes it's not pumping. And so it has a couple different phases. When it's pumping, we call it the systolic phase. And the time when it's not pumping, when it's relaxing, we call that diastole or the diastolic phase, right? And they got to follow each other. For years and years and years, people were very interested in systole, and that means when the heart is pumping, because when the heart doesn't contract properly, it doesn't maintain blood pressure, that can be really dangerous. And people weren't so interested in diastolic function. But now we're very interested in diastolic function, because in order for the heart to pump blood, guess what has to happen to the heart first? It's got to relax, and it has to relax so that it can fill with blood. If it can't fill with blood, then even if it contracts normally, it's not going to pump any. Okay, so diastolic function is just as important. All right, so both atria contract together simultaneously, and then after a little delay, both ventricles contract. One way to think about heart contraction is that the heart contracts as a unit, right, which is not bad, but in this class, you have to realize that the atria contract a little bit before the ventricles, but both atria contract followed by both ventricles. And we noticed, or we mentioned before, that systemic blood pressure is pretty high. Good normal value is 120 over 80. And these two numbers here refer to systolic function, or systolic blood pressure over diastolic blood pressure. Because as the heart relaxes, the pressure in arteries decreases. And it would go to zero. But it doesn't go to zero because what happens? The heart contracts again, right? And pumps it back up to 120. Then it relaxes, goes to 80, goes back up. All right, so that's the systemic blood pressure. But because the pulmonary circulation is so much shorter, the pressure there is about 25 over 10. So that is way reduced. Here are a couple numbers or concepts that we want to work with when we look at heart function, and that is end-diastolic volume. So volume is just the volume of a ventricle at the end of diastole. So tell me something about that. What is diastole? When the heart is pumping or relaxing? Is relaxing. And what happens when the heart is relaxing? It is filling with blood, and as it fills with blood, the ventricle gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, right? So end-diastolic volume is the volume of a ventricle when it's full of blood, when it's at its biggest, its largest volume, okay? And systolic volume, and I'm going to skip one, and systolic volume, what is systole again? When the heart is contracting, right, it's pumping blood when that happens, and at the end of systole, that's when the volume of a ventricle is the smallest, right, because the heart has pumped, right, so end systolic, amount of blood left in the ventricles at the end of systole. When there's blood in a ventricle can't pump all of it out, can't pump 100% out, but a large fraction. Right, and that fraction is what we call the stroke volume. The stroke volume is the actual amount of blood in terms of mLs, or volume that the heart pumps every time it beats. And so a way that we calculate stroke volume is that we take end-diastolic volume and subtract end-systolic volume from it, and what do we get? How much blood was pumped for that particular heartbeat. All right, so be able to calculate stroke volume given end-diastolic and end-systolic volume. Or if you're given stroke volume and end-systolic volume, you should be able to calculate end-diastolic volume, right? Just a nice algebraic equation. Let me look at these questions here. Which is larger, ESV or ESV? That's a really nasty question. Okay, which is larger, EDV or ESV? End-diastolic volume is larger or end-systolic volume is larger? And diastolic volume, because that's when the heart is filling with blood. That's when the heart is relaxing. Okay. What is the stroke volume if ESV is 20 and EDV is 80? Well, you can calculate. It's just what? You just subtract those two numbers from each other and don't get a negative number. Okay, you got it. Okay, since the heart is contracting and relaxing, it has those two different phases and they repeat each other, so there is something we call a cycle, a cardiac cycle. And there's a really good diagram that we're going to look at probably on the next slide. I want to point out just a couple things here before we get to that nice slide. As the ventricles contract, okay, pressure increases, right? Think of a water balloon, grab it in your hand, squeeze down on the balloon. What happens to the pressure inside the balloon? It goes up. Okay, so the ventricles contract, and if all the valves to that particular chamber are closed, if there's no way for blood to get in or out of that particular chamber, and that muscle is contracting, okay, we call that isovolumetric contraction, because all the valves are closed, right? And if the heart is contracting and there's no way for blood to get out, what happens to the pressure? Think of that water balloon again, right? You tied it off, water can't get out, you squeeze it down, pressure goes up. Right, even though the volume of that balloon isn't changing very much. Okay, when the pressure in the ventricle exceeds that in the aorta, right, then blood is going to be ejected from a ventricle into the aorta, Because a fluid will flow according to pressure. It will always flow from high pressure to low pressure, just like a molecule will diffuse from high concentration to low concentration. So fluid, whether it's a gas or liquid, will move from high pressure to low pressure. That's going to be a nice important principle for us to rely on all the time. There is another phase of the heart cycle where all the valves are closed, but the heart is relaxing. And so we call that isovolumetric relaxation. When the pressure in the ventricles falls below the atria, then the valves between the atria and ventricle open. And blood will flow from an atria into a ventricle. All right, so let's take a look at this illustration. I like the one in your lab book. I made that an exam figure. Okay, hopefully you find that in your study guide. Okay, and there's also an answer key to that because part of this figure is unlabeled. And then there's like a choices over here, which you use to label this particular diagram. So make sure that you can label that diagram, right? And the answer key is there. A couple little errors in the one that is in your lab manual, but not very big errors. All right, so I see a bunch of graphs on this particular illustration, right? So in order to understand a graph, what do we have to know first? The axes, right? So let's look at some of these axes. All right, so they're all versus time, and it's always the same time scale. The vertical axis is different. This first one right here is pressure. And it's going to measure pressure in an atrium, and pressure in a ventricle, and pressure in an artery. All right, and let's think about the left side of the heart. All right, so if it's the left side of the heart, then this pressure inside the ventricle is the left ventricle. Left ventricle pumps blood into the systemic artery, which is the aorta, and the atria that pumps blood into the ventricle is what? The left atrium. So left atrium, left ventricle, aorta, and it is what? Pressure. So what's a normal blood pressure? Yeah, 120 over 80, and that should be in a systemic artery, and the aorta is a systemic artery, and you see 120 over 80 on this particular trace. So you guys are lucky because you can probably see the color. Are they color-coded? Okay. So here is a trace of the aorta. Here is, what is this pressure right here? This is the lowest pressure that I see. And how do we find this pressure? Come on, cursor. How do we find that pressure? Move over to the pressure axis, and it says 80. What's the highest pressure? I see it right here, and it is 120. Right? So you don't have to memorize that particular number, right, if you see this diagram. All right, so that's the pressure in the aorta. Now, what about the pressure in a ventricle? Does it go from 120 to 80? No, it goes from, come on, cursor. It goes from zero, okay, to just a little bit over 120. So the pressure in a ventricle actually goes to zero, but the pressure in the aorta never does. That's a good thing, because you need pressure in order for blood to move from high pressure to low pressure. Okay, and then here is pressure inside the atria. Okay, so here I see, right in this region right here, I see higher pressure in an atrium compared to a ventricle. Right? And when there's higher pressure in an atria compared to a ventricle, there's a pressure difference, and so which way is blood going to flow? High to low, so blood is going to flow from where? From an atrium. Oh, come on, cursor. Atrium into a ventricle during this period of time. Okay? All right, and as the ventricle starts to contract, the pressure in the ventricle gets higher than the atrium, so blood is going to want to flow from a ventricle back into an atrium, but can it if it's a normal heart? Hopefully, you see that it can't because there's an atrioventricular valve there. And on the left side of the heart, what is the atrioventricular, what's the name of that atrioventricular valve? It is the mitral valve or bicuspid valve, right? So at that particular time, when the pressure in a ventricle increases above the atria, then that mitral valve closes and it makes a sound. Okay? Oh, and it says right here, AV valve closes, right? AV valve, mitral valve. Okay, and then the ventricles still contracts, keeps contracting, but But during this period of time, the aortic valve is closed. So since all the valves to that chamber are closed, this is what we call isovolumetric contraction. All the valves are closed. When does the aortic valve open? Aortic valve, let's look at this trace over here. So I see high pressure in the aorta, low pressure in the ventricle. Which way is blood going to want to go? It's going to want to go from aorta to a ventricle, but if it's a normal heart, can it? It cannot because of the aortic semilunar valve is closed, right? That valve works just like that. All right, so during this period of time, say this period of time, the aortic valve is closed, right? And at this time, the AV valve closes, so both valves are closed, so this is what we call isovolumetric contraction. But as soon as the pressure inside the ventricle is greater than the aorta, what happens to the aortic valve? It opens, right, just passively. Blood will push it open, then blood is going to flow from the ventricle into the aorta. And eventually the ventricle is going to run out of blood to pump, right? All the blood has been pumped out, and then the pressure in the ventricle is going to start to decrease once again. Right through here. Okay, so at this point in time, aortic valve opens. Right here, I see now the pressure in the ventricle is less than the aorta. Blood is going to want to flow from aorta back into a ventricle, but what prevents that from happening? The aortic semilunar valve. So the aortic semilunar valve closes, right here. As soon as pressure in the aorta is greater than the ventricle, and the AV valve is still closed, so this is what we call the isovolumetric relaxation phase of the heart. All right, and as the pressure in the ventricle decreases below that of the atria, then the AV valve opens up. Okay, and then this cycle just repeats itself. I see this little dip in blood pressure of the aorta. We call that a dicrotic notch, and that's because some pressure in the aorta, okay, some pressure in the aorta is necessary to close the aortic semilunar valve. And that's why we see this little dip right here. All right, let's look at the next lines. The next line is volume, and it's just volume of a ventricle. All right, so where is the end diastolic volume? So I'm going to move the cursor, and you tell me where to stop. End diastolic volume. Is that the biggest volume or the smallest volume? At the end of diastole is the biggest one because that's when the heart has filled. All right, so where is end diastolic volume? Right here. It's right at the beginning of systole. That's the end diastolic volume. Where is the end systolic volume? That's the smallest volume, which is right here. So by looking at this graph, would you be able to calculate stroke volume? Absolutely. Which is what? Would be 50, would be 130 minus 50 would be the stroke volume because this is ventricular volume. Okay. Does the volume of the ventricle change during this isovolumetric contraction? Is the volume changing? No. That's how it got its name. What about isovolumetric relaxation? Again, all the valves are closed. It's not changing. And I see the volume of the ventricle decreasing during this ejection phase when the pressure in the ventricle is higher than the aorta. Right? That's when this volume is going to decrease. And then as the heart relaxes, right, then the ventricles fill with blood and the pressure or the volume increases as they fill with blood during diastole. So here you should be able to identify systole and systole and diastole. All right, so this, if the heart makes some sounds when valves close. This first heart sound happens when the AV valve closes, right? And the second heart sound happens when the semilunar valves close. So probably have to think about that, but look at this graph, that will tell you. And I'm not so concerned about this third heart sound over here. The last trace that I see is what we call electrocardiogram. This is a measure of the electrical activity inside the heart on the surface of somebody's body. Right? And there are a number of waves. This first one is what we call the primavera wave, but instead of saying that, we just say P wave. Okay? And this P wave represents depolarization of atria. And what kind of event is depolarization? Excitatory, right? Okay. Depolarization and contraction are not exactly the same thing, but they're close, right? This is just electrical events of the heart. A P wave is necessary to signal the start of contraction, right? So this electrocardiogram is not tension or pressure, it's just electrical activity. All right, then I see a QRS complex. But I don't see a cursor. Here it is, QRS complex. QRS complex represents depolarization of the ventricles. So from this ECG, can you tell me that the atria depolarized before the ventricles? Yeah, you can tell me that. And that also means that the atria are going to contract slightly before the ventricles. You can tell that. All right, so in order for something to depolarize, it has to be at resting membrane potential. So if something is depolarized, what has to happen before it can depolarize again? It has to repolarize. All right, so the atria repolarize during the same time that the ventricles depolarize. So I don't see a way for atrial repolarization. Right, because this QRS complex is so big, it obliterates the signal from the atria because the atria are really thin, right? They don't have a lot of cells. There's not a lot of mass to an atria, but there is a lot of mass to the left ventricle. The electrical activity in the left ventricle overshadows everything that's coming from the atria. Right, so QRS complex is depolarization of the ventricles, and embedded in that signal is a very, very small one from repolarization of the atria. All right, so if the ventricles depolarize, what do they have to do before they can depolarize again? They have to repolarize, and that happens during the T wave. All right, so it's P, QRS, and T. T wave represents repolarization of the ventricles, and it's a pretty big wave because the ventricles are pretty large. And so what you notice on this particular slide is that the QRS complex, which is depolarization, occurs a little bit before contraction of the ventricles, which makes sense. You can see that on this diagram. Okay? And these other waves probably aren't so important, but probably you should see that the QRS precedes contraction of the ventricles. All right, so I think for now that's all I'm going to say about this particular slide. But just remember that fluid flows from high pressure to low pressure. And there's high pressure in an artery, right, then it's going to want to flow back into the heart, and if there's a valve there, that prevents it. But if pressure in the ventricle is higher than the artery, then blood is going to flow from a ventricle into that artery. Okay? Okay. Heart sounds, heart murmurs. All right, so we're going to pick up a little bit with heart murmurs and then go right to electrical activity of the heart next time. So sign-in sheet is going around somewhere. Look at that nice Wiggers diagram in your lab manual. That's what that diagram is called. It shows volumes and pressures, ECG.